Now, over the past week, we have witnessed more tragic mass shootings in the United States and in Australia. We've watched the fear, the violence is instilled in the Jewish communities and campus students across the world. And once again, the question follows, why does this violence happen and what can be done to stop it? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe. Now, some shootings can be described as random, but in many cases, the evidence says otherwise, as usually an intended target or targets. In countries where gun violence is common, attacks tend to cluster. One follows another, sometimes just days or weeks apart. And researchers call this imitation, not coincidence. And we in the media know that blanket coverage matters. Names, images, notoriety, attention can become part of the motivation. That's why some countries now avoid naming perpetrators at all. And then there's access, quite simply, and the research on this is fairly uniform. Fewer guns means fewer deaths. As for Europe, well, we've been spared a lot of gun violence on scale thus far, but that doesn't mean it can't change. So this podcast isn't just about what's happened, it's about what we and policymakers do next. Peter Squires is Professor of Criminology and Public Policy at the University of Brighton and an expert on gun crime and firearms control. And I'm also joined by Orla Muldoon, who is a Professor of Psychology at the University of Limerick. Peter and Orla, you're both very welcome to News Talk Daily. Peter, I might start with yourself, and your work has looked directly at, I suppose, the evidence when it comes to gun violence. What does the international data tell us about gun control in particular and its impact on the frequency of these events?
Problem with these events is that they are, by their very nature, fairly rare. You're always in a very difficult position trying to prevent rare events and proving an association. The overall level of gun violence the world over closely correlates with the level of gun ownership. Mass shootings are a different matter. However, the American evidence, and that's where we've got most gun violence, most mass shootings, clearly shows there's a relationship between tight gun control and effective monitoring of gun ownership in the different states and the level of mass shootings. So there's a fairly clear, America is our best case study on this. Not that we really want to be able to show lots of gun violence. Mm. Australia, having had the terrible 1996 Port Arthur mass shooting where 35 people were killed, banned what we generally regard as assault rifles and semi-automatic rifles, as well as pump-action shotguns. And they haven't had, until the recent event in Bondi Beach, another mass shooting. So the message went out that the swift, comprehensive gun control laws and effective policing and a good licensing system can clearly help reduce the risk of mass shootings.
Mm. Well, what are the current rules around gun ownership in Australia? Obviously, look, in Ireland, it's a bit of an alien culture for us. I know it's different in other parts of Europe. And like you said, the US is maybe the prime resistor to control over guns. But in Australia, would it be relatively common for families, particularly in rural parts, I assume, to have a firearm?
The level of ownership is nowhere near. No, nowhere is anywhere near that of the USA. But Australia saw a dip in gun ownership after Port Arthur. But since the last couple of decades, it's clearly been growing. There were thought to be about 4 million gun owners in Australia, and that number has been growing. Australia has some of the most advanced policing of 3D printed firearms, but you don't get those used in mass shootings. The broader idea of a gun culture, it's associated with hunting. That's the official reason that people will be owning guns or sports shooting, but many people have them for quite other reasons. I think we have to do something about the kind of flag of convenience reasons whereby people become eligible to own guns, because often they don't do with them what they claim they're going to do when they apply to purchase them. Mm. So there's an underlying issue. And it relates to all what I would call frontier societies, and that applies to the USA, Canada, large parts of Latin America. gun ownership was part and parcel of how those societies evolved. People lived by hunting. They had to fight for their survival, and guns became part of that kind of culture. Now, that they're not frontier societies anymore. So I think we have to kind of question the legitimacy of widespread gun ownership in modern societies.
So if you were advising the Australian government, and straight away the Prime Minister came out, had a cabinet meeting and said he was willing to consider tighter gun controls, which you might expect him to say, I suppose, and a lot of us would, what would you advise those gun controls look like?
Well, the problem with gun controls is it's not just about the laws. I mean, I'm a criminologist. We know that people break laws. So it's as much about how those laws are enforced, how diligently the police monitor the licensing process when someone applies to have a gun, how proactively they look at people's circumstances. So, you know, you may have had a gun for years, but if you're now drinking heavily and your wife has left you, you may well be spiraling out of control. And I think we, even in the UK, we've had occasions where people have owned guns for a long time, but then their lives have started to change. They maybe lost their job. They may become bitter. They start posting weird stuff online. And I think that, if you like, the gun-owning community needs to be monitored more effectively. We even had cases where someone was arrested for an offence and then the police confiscated their guns. And because the case never quite made it to court, they gave him the guns back. And then a few days later, he went and perpetrated the mass shooting in Plymouth in 2021. So I think a lot of it is not just the law, it's the management and monitoring of the law by the police and the authorities responsible for gun licensing.
You've said that these events are extremely rare, and thankfully they are, particularly outside of America, which I suppose begs the question that maybe some gun lobby groups might put: should you legislate based on the black swan event, or do you legislate for more everyday scenarios? Like, is the one in 100 what you need to legislate for?
I think you have to manage risk, and we have seen enough cases now. I mean, yes, America has the lion's share of them. About 40% of mass shootings in the world occur in America. But we've had plenty. Most European countries have had one or two. England and Wales and Scotland have had five. I mean, so these are rare events, but they're massive tragedies when they occur, and they've all pointed to lessons that needed to have been learned, that people need to listen more, that we need to have some kind of system for monitoring the mental well-being of gun owners. There need to be, as there now are in many US states, red flag laws, so that there is somewhere that concerned members of the public who know a gun owner who is behaving strangely have someone to report to. Maybe we need to monitor people's social media. There are lots of things that need to be done, and I don't think it's not legislating for individuals. It's having a regime by which we ensure the safety of the guns in the community that are being held in people's homes. And I think there are a lot more things we can do. When we've looked at incidents that have occurred, there are many lessons that might have been learned. We had a guy not so long ago who bought a gun in a car park in Luton and was then proposing to take it to a school to initiate a school shooting. What no one realised, that these kinds of private sales were very common. And the purchaser then had 7 days to alert the police that he'd now bought the gun. Now, it turned out he was using a fraudulently produced certificate to enable him to buy the gun off the seller. But who knew that these private sales were occurring? I don't think it's safe to have two private individuals, unsupervised, transferring a firearm in a car park. So I think every time there have been lessons that we needed to learn, and those loopholes, if you like, needed closing.
Orla Muldoon is also on the line, is a professor of psychology at the University of Limerick. And I suppose, Orla, you've written quite a lot of articles in the immediate aftermath of these shootings, including here in Europe. The events that we've seen in the last couple of weeks in Bondi and a brand university, what kind of worried you about the tenor and the tone of those in particular?
Well, I guess the events in the US, I think, are part of a wider pattern. So unlike maybe how Peter studies things, I study these kinds of things from a perspective of what is shared about them rather than what is unique to the individuals or the people doing them.
Mm.
So to me, the American shootings are definitely part of a wider pattern of angry young men often taking aim in educational contexts. Often young men who are unhappy with the system, unhappy with the educational system, often in schools, universities. So I think there's a very clear pattern there. I think the Australian shooting is a different beast, and as Peter has already pointed out, far less frequent occurrence in Australia. Australia, like in fact Scotland and the UK after Dunblane, has very good gun control law. So I do think gun control is really a central part of the puzzle here. And one thing I'd like to pick you up on, if I may,
mm-hmm.
is that actually there is 7 guns per 100 people in Ireland. So the idea that we aren't an armed country probably isn't quite correct, but we don't have semi-automatic weapons, maybe. But we certainly do have frequent rural firearms incidents. Most of the people who hold firearms tend to be, like Peter says, associated with land and all the rest of it. But there are quite a lot of guns in Ireland.
Yeah, that'd be one that I have to say would surprise me that it's that high. And I would imagine a lot of people, is the majority of that, like you say, it's farmers who have a gun on the farm or whatever. Where do we see the concentration of these guns in Ireland? And I presume that's legally held firearms you're talking about as well.
I know far less about illegally held firearms, but certainly we all know that there are illegally held firearms in Ireland. But the idea that this couldn't happen in Ireland is very problematic because there are so many. And availability of a gun is the biggest single predictor of whether or not this is likely to happen. And then there is the copycat element and the imitation element. And there's actually quite good evidence from the States that there is a social contagion effect, that there's clustering around these types of incidents, in part because there tends to be a lot of publicity and even valorization of the people who perpetrate the crimes. Do you know, when we think of children when they're small and one child hits another, it's often the attention is on the child who did the hitting rather than on the victim.
Mm.
And that is the same in this context, and that feeds the people who perpetrate these crimes.
Do you think then there's a question for how the media covers these, and in what way is there a more responsible way to do it, for example? Because look, social media, the media in general will argue, people will argue there's a lot of shock and awe trying to be first with the details when it comes to these kind of things. Is there a more responsible way that they could be covered, particularly when information is sparse at the start of when these start to get reported?
I guess one of the things that all of us could do is de-emphasize the individual causes. I think we always try and look for a reason that somebody does this that is idiosyncratic, rather than looking at the context in which we live and which facilitates this kind of behavior. There is no question that what has happened in Australia is part of a wider problem to do with the Middle East. And none of the issues that took those shooters out on that day started the day before.
Mm.
And Irish people should be very aware of how it is that people can become radicalized and over-identified with political causes and go out and kill and injure others. And it's not nice to have that done in your name, and it's not nice to be the victim of that. So we are living in a global context that is incredibly difficult and divisive. And in fact, how we speak about people who aren't like us and how the media covers differences, to me, is a key issue that we need to be really very careful about.
That's largely in the context of Bondi that we have been talking. But if we look, and you said the more frequent, the college shootings in the US, the maybe one or two people, and we do tend to see a pattern, as you mentioned, young men, easier than ever, I would argue, for a young man to feel left out by the modern world, to go down a hole on the internet, to find themselves in a very difficult headspace. And they seem to be a demographic that are just very difficult to reach.
I agree. And I think one of the things that really bothers me about the coverage of the American phenomena in particular is how we often see the term lone wolf as if this person is somehow singular and idiosyncratic and acting alone. But yet the shooters really do share very clear characteristics. They're often male. They're often between the ages of 17 and 30. They often have opted out of education. They've had difficulty enacting their masculinity in a way that is functional in a very unequal society. They are radicalized by people who really shouldn't be preying on the vulnerable and vulnerable young men. So I think that all of the time we have a narrative that is this lone wolf, an individual acting alone, is a classic statement that you will hear about the American phenomena. But in fact, we're resisting the idea that this is a shared problem and there are collective attributes and particular demographics, young men in particular, who are being left behind and have no way to enact their masculinity in a functional way and become angry. And become angry with, you know, education because it has let them down. So to me, you know, there's work to be done there, whether it's by the media, social media, politicians, to reorient us to the idea that it isn't all about mental health or somebody being different as somehow a lone wolf.
Yeah, even that term lone wolf has a certain masculine connotation, doesn't it? That, you know, that this wolf is a sort of a symbol of strength and being alone. And, you know, there's a lot there. And Peter, I might give the final word to you, because as Orla was just saying there, even in a country that we think has very strict laws or very strict control over it, like here in Ireland, and I'm sure some would argue in the UK as well, for countries that do have those strict laws already, are there weak points there that we should be paying attention to before a shooting like we've seen in other countries happens?
I think there are. By the way, I mean, I do agree with Orla's comments about the kind of demonization of young men and the way in which they can be ostracized within institutions, schools or workplaces, and they resent and resist that. So one of the ideas, and many US universities have adopted this, is a kind of listening campaign. Ironically, much like they have in prisons, so that if people are thought likely to commit suicide, people are around and monitoring the any strange behaviours or traits. There's also the issue of lots of these mass shooters, whether they be lone wolves or just angry individuals, they pronounce what they're going to do on social media. So again, I think we need to take that much more seriously. People live lives online, and a lot of the kind of radicalization and ostracism occurs digitally. So there's another point. And together they result in the kind of red flag laws, so that people are looking for signs that someone who you know has got a gun is starting to behave erratically or make kind of statements and I suppose preach hate, really. So a lot of that needs to be done, but it's also down to the licensing process. And lots of societies monitor people when they get a gun and then renew the license after 3 or 5 years or however many years. And that becomes fairly automatic. That there needs to be more proactive looking at who are the gun owners and what other aspects of their life are like. So if they are going through social, personal, domestic, employment crises and they've got a gun, that's a time that the risks are accented. And I especially so in the case of people who are espousing radical and hateful causes. So a lot of it has been associated with a kind of new right-wing racist stereotypes, anti-women stereotypes. A lot of mass shooters, men, overwhelmingly men, target women as if women were to blame for all their difficulties. So I think there's a lot of things captured in the notion of red flag laws, people looking, monitoring, proactive intervention by police to sort of maintain a proper eye on who's got guns, how many they've got, where they are, how they keep them, whether they actually use them for their stated purpose on the license. So there's a lot that more can be done, and those are the loopholes through which these problems emerge.
Peter Squires, Professor of Criminology and Public Policy at the University of Brighton, and Orla Muldoon, Professor of Psychology at the University of Limerick. Thank you so much for joining me on News Talk Daily. And don't forget, you can get in touch with the podcast. The email address is newstalkdaily@newstalk.com. If you've thoughts on this episode or any of the other ones, frankly, my thanks to producer Tom Donnelly and Micheál O'Connell on research. That's it for today. And I'll be back with you again tomorrow. Chat soon.